Welcome to the Embodied Educator podcast, where we explore the deep connection between body and mind in education. I'm your host, Liz Wientjes, and each episode we dive into how different embodied elements, like our physical space, our sensations, our movements, our nervous system, shape the way we learn, teach, and grow. I'll be talking with education experts from around the world, sharing their latest insights on embodiment in the classroom and beyond. Whether you're an educator or a lifelong learner, you'll find practical tools to explore and apply. Join me as we uncover ways to bring embodied teaching to life. Let's reshape education one breath at a time. I love you to meet Jessica White, a deeply loving neurodiverse writer of stories that heal the soul. She's an educator, a mom, homeschooler, a curious cyclical beauty, and embodied coach for authors and storytellers. With her platform, Authors Apothecary, which is a gorgeous name, she supports writers get unstuck and reconnect to their true authority through embodied self-care. She's actually a fully trained educator. By the time she was ready to enter the education world, chronic illness knocked her off her feet. In the end, this path of healing and dealing with chronic illness and neurodiversity ignited her true calling for whole body living and cyclical living, writing and learning. Bold and beautiful, she decided to work and live and raise her kids in a more embodied way, away from the rigid school system in the United States. This bright power woman leads the way in our honest conversation, by opening up how it is to navigate the world with a strong neurotypical focus. I believe all teachers of some classroom should listen and realize how dominant embodied frames can limit so much of our neurodiverse learners and actually keep them small. Let's dive in to this new year with powerful and daring cyclical advice from Jessica, how to heal our relationships with time, energy, attention, and space through seasonal living, somatic practices, and self-compassion. Enjoy. Welcome, Jessica. So glad you could make it in the beginning, early January, to meet up for our talk.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So as it is the fresh beginning of a new year and you're into cyclical intelligence, my first question would be, do you do anything regarding this, well, some say big transition, small transition? How do you look at that from that cyclical perspective? Is that any ritual or something for you?
I kind of look at it actually a little earlier than the new year. So typically I start at Advent, kind of preparing and like reflecting on like the end of last year and how I want to transition into the new year. And then usually by the winter solstice, I kind of have like a word for the year or kind of an intention for the year, what we call a mind, body, spirit intention, that I kind of want to pull into the new year. So that's around like the 21st, 22nd, depending on the year. And that gives me about a week, you know, you still have Christmas and all in there, to kind of like figure out what energy I want to take into the new year. So this year is actually kind of a rest, like is the underlying feeling, like I don't need to rush into this new year. But sometimes it is like, when I did threshold was my word for the year. It was like, it really did feel like we were transitioning into a new period of time and a new thing. So it was a much more like stepping through a door, like a more solid thing. Now this one is much more like I just kind of feel like I'm easing into this year, and like 2025 started a month ago but also is starting right now. And you know, like if I don't get everything that needs doing in this season done, it's okay because it's a rest period. And so for me that's like kind of how I is. So my word for this year is beautiful, and I'm really just kind of being very intentional about adding beauty to my day, adding beauty to my relationships, adding beauty to like, you know, I've always kind of cleaned as I go kind of thing, or leave things better than you found them type person. So, you know, just like, can I put a new centerpiece in the middle of a table, or can I, you know, do those little things that just make things feel a little bit more beautiful. Yeah. And I'm just kind of having that awareness, even with, we're just getting our first cold snap of the year, and like my yard. You know, it looks dead and dry, but it's also got kind of some green grass because it never really died. But you know, there's this beauty in that, like this contradiction of there's dandelions literally in the middle of January. You know, like there's some kind of beauty in that, and just
Yeah.
kind of noticing those little things that we kind of take for granted or look over, kind of.
Yeah. It makes me think of the beauty of the imperfections, like almost taking a moment to realize that that can hold beauty as well, instead of the maybe efficiency or proactive mode where it needs to be cut and green and like I'm now thinking
Yes.
of the grass. That's beautiful. And I also like that you said the year already started earlier, so you went in with such an awareness and preparation in a, it sounds very gentle though, like it's the way is a little bit paved instead of, oh yeah, I need to do this new year thing. And that's a wonderful way to start it. And actually, I think I rushed into it. And then I also realized, well, I can take my ritual because I did a ritual of also finding a word and looking back on what is it, what was my role then? How do I want to change that role in the new year? And I took it over 3 or 4 days and I thought, let's just do it, you know, in an afternoon. And then the beauty of the imperfection, it doesn't come and show itself, does it?
And you know, having ADHD, I kind of have an all or nothing type, like, you
Oh.
know, personality underneath that. And so it's like sometimes I'm like, why will the word not come to me? Like, I really thought, you know, usually I can just kind of sit down and it kind of just comes. I'll like look over my journals and I'll look through things, and some word or words will stick out, and I'll kind of like meditate on those words. And then, but actually, what came to me first was a system to carry into the new year. And I was like, well, I mean, I guess I could have 4 words for the new year, you know? And but it was this idea of contemplating and then curating things and then creating things and then cultivating relationship around those things. And that, I mean, it's a beautiful system. And I'm like, great, that's a thing. And that's actually kind of where the beautiful word came from, was like, well, it's a lovely system, but like, you know, is that really my word for the year?
What is that
And
going to bring me?
I was like, well, what is it between those and my core values that really kind of brings those together? And my primary core value is authentic beauty. And I was like, well, you know, I've done authenticity several times, and it's kind of one of those words I feel I've explored a lot. And I was like, I have a love-hate relationship with the word beauty because I don't wear makeup. I'm not a jewelry person. I don't even put nail polish on. You know, like I don't really care about the physicality of beauty.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I do care that the world is beautiful. I do care that we see the good in things. And that's where it came from. It's like, okay, well, then maybe I should figure out a way to like embody the beauty in a way, like, you know, that beautiful person who's inside of me, you know, like how does that express and how does that feel and how does that, you know, on a mind, body, soul level, you know, like I think we think a lot, you know, with beauty of physicality,
Oh,
but I
yeah.
actually think the opposite. I'm very mentally aware of beauty. I can see it everywhere and I can feel it in my soul, but my body is actually one of those areas where I'm not real keen on like understanding beauty. And so it's kind of a challenge to myself this year to
Yeah.
really like, what is it, what feels beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
Even in like what I'm wearing, like this material is like, it's a beautiful material. And I was like, specifically wore this because I knew I was going to be talking about it. I was like, it's something I feel comfortable in, but it's also something that like fits to my skin in a way. And I'm probably also autistic. I have an autistic child, and I'm very sensitive to texture. And so one of the reasons I avoid my body in general is because like I suddenly become hyper aware. Like I hate wearing shoes. I become hyper aware I'm wearing shoes, and I'm like, oh, I gotta get them off, you know. And so sometimes I tune out of my body just because I get oversensitized. But I'm trying to really be intentional with like what I'm wearing or the food I'm putting into my body and how it makes me feel, or you know, the Like right now we're talking and it's like I probably should drink some water because I'm going to be talking a lot and I can already tell it's kind of getting that tightness. Like it's just that awareness of what is beautiful and in your body. It's just a new thing for me to explore, so.
It's actually while you were talking, I was because well, the main context of the podcast is of course embodied educator. So I come from a background of teaching and then thinking of classrooms, but those classrooms can be in so many places where we share knowledge. And you also addressed it in such a beautiful way where I was imagining like how could we also pay attention to beauty in those places of learning? Because so often they're so hyper focused on
Yes.
getting things done and learning and cognitive and just everything that needs to happen in the room that we tend to forget to look at the parts that are arising, as tacit knowledge in the unspoken, in the different elements, and embodying beauty, like you said, as a focus for yourself. It sounds like such a wonderful skill to grow.
So one of the places I actually first learned beauty and kind of embodiment as well was Waldorf education. When I was researching for homeschooling my kids and what kind of like curriculum I wanted to use or what kind of methodology I wanted to use, I had a very sensitive dyslexic child who didn't really want to engage in academics, and so I really kind of settled on that like Waldorf style for her. And then my second child came along, and by that point I was in unschooling, but I always kind of took those like the rhythms of Waldorf. Waldorf is very cyclical based, and very beauty based. It's they use chalkboard art and they don't do a lot of the like book learning and stuff until they've learned like movement and the gross motor skills stuff, and so like you use the side of a crayon instead of the tip of a crayon before you learn the other way. So like it's all those little pieces and parts of gross motor, but in a beautiful way, a storytelling way, which also appeals to me as an author. It's like the storytelling, like even math is a story. And I just loved that. And mixing that with a little bit of Montessori free, association with manipulatives and things of that sort was really helpful for those early years. And then adding in the outdoor education of just being out in nature and getting some physical activity and sunlight and the things they need to build all those big muscle groups. I mean, that was where I kind of started. And I didn't know about embodiment at that point, but I kind of like intuitively knew those were really important skills that we don't teach in American education or have been taken out of it, American education, almost like recesses, maybe 30 minutes if you're lucky, And like this idea that we don't have to sit still and be, or be, in a one spot. They just don't have that freedom of expression, that beauty of movement. And so I gravitated towards that.
And maybe we can dive in a little deeper because I heard you say, because I know you're a homeschooling mom now, right? And I also heard you say the word unschooling. So I wonder how did the process go because you were drawn already to Waldorf education. Like, did you even put them in like traditional school? How did that go for you as a parent, as an educator, and how what does it entail? And let's get later on then into the cyclicity and how that works for
Yeah,
you as an
I'll work
educator.
it back in. I actually got my degree in education and I was going to be an educator, but I got my chronic illnesses kind of came into effect right about the time that I would have been out in the school. And I have an autoimmune disorder that makes me like super, like if I get sick, it attacks my organs. And school environments, it's like you're pretty much guaranteed to get sick.
Germs are flying around.
So I never went into the public education environment. However, I'd read a lot of John Holt and James Tyler Gatto and these other ideas about what was missing from education, bell hooks and other people, that I just kind of started realizing that the education system that is available now in America is not the same education even I had. And I was the first generation of testing. You know, I was like the guinea pig generation. But we still had like nap time during kindergarten, and you know, we did song learning to learn our multiplication tables, but they don't really do that kind of stuff anymore. And so I was like, you know what? I have the background, I have the education and the love of education to do it. So I'll just teach them myself. And that knowledge, though, got me connected to somebody else who was very interested in starting a democratic school, which is a free school or an unschool. It's essentially just a student-led school where their interests drive the education. They go by several names, but they wanted to start a school, and we started as a co-op, with me and her kind of leading it, and a couple other moms that were kind of like a support moms to help with whatever the kids' interests were. So like, I don't know anything about sewing, but somebody else knew something about sewing. So if a kid had an interest in sewing, we sent them to her. And you know, like just watching kids just light up about learning something and getting really interested in something reminded me why I loved education. And so to bring that back, you know, I put my kids in that democratic school for a couple of years. We moved, so I went back to homeschooling. And then the pandemic hit, which, you know, has pretty much kept us on this track at this point. But I still have that in my like core values of education, is that it really should be students' interests, because just like eating, intuitive eating, you know, like it's all those things. It's like if we don't truly enjoy the process, our brains don't make memories and they don't hold that information for long periods. And as somebody who's also neurodiverse and has neurodiverse children, it's even worse because our working memory, just like, you know, it could be different in 3 seconds. So I can say something literally to my child, and if they have no interest in it, they're going to forget it before I take my next breath. And so there's no reason to try to force education like that. It's just going to make both of us grumpy and hate each other. So I try to do that. I try to like bring in fact, I'm sitting at my table. So like, you know, this book is very beautiful. I have a 14-year-old who's a drawer. And so like, instead of picking a textbook on nature, you know, this one has beautiful little drawings, and then I can encourage the child to draw, you know, like the things that are true to where we live. So we do a lot more things that are oriented towards my very visual oriented child, where it's not sit and read this whole textbook paragraph over here, or listen to this really boring video, you know, that's not going to interest you at all. It interests me because I'm a word learner.
Actually,
I can read books all day and just be happy as can be, but that is n neither one of my children. And so doing that, and then bringing it back to the cyclical living, it's we school year round. We don't try to force education into 180 days. And so, you know, it allows
That
us
literally means you don't do holidays. How do I look at
well, what
that?
it means is that like we do it until we're done with it. So, you know, we're kind of at different grade levels and everything. We don't have to report in or test in the state. So we have that freedom. But like, if my child wants to do 2 years of math, but only like half a year of science, you know, we have the privilege of doing that and taking it at that pace of when the brain is developing versus trying to force, okay, you got to finish all of third grade stuff, you know, by May. And that really helps us, you know, first regulate our nervous systems because we're not stressing over what we're learning. And two, it lets me say, you know what, you know, we need to like advance in this area, but let's not do it that way. I can change like mid-season and say, you know what, we're not going to use that book anymore. We're going to go over here and we're going to try this because that's where you're interested right now. And being able to do that, which I would love, you know, like if every kid could have that, to be able to really like follow their interests. And what you see, and a lot of, if you talk to homeschoolers, you'll see this a lot, is a child who may not read till they're 12, but then they're like suddenly college level within 2 or 3 years, because it's like they suddenly get this interest. And it's not that they haven't been picking up the skills, it's just that they haven't been really using them. And so it's kind of like, you know, I know how to manipulate clay, but if I sit and I really focus on it, I can start to learn how to sculpt. And then I can learn how to use the tools. And then as soon as I learn how to use the tools, I've already got the visual skills of knowing what that's supposed to look like. And suddenly I can do it really well if I put in the hours. And
Sounds
so,
like they're allowed to follow their own inner rhythm in more
yes.
ways and not so much structured in a curriculum of now you need to do this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that I learned when I was even in that very rigid system was that I would do all the work over the summer. I would go to the public library and pull the textbook out for that next grade level, and I would read it, and I'd be done in like 3 or 4 weeks with a, you know, whole textbook. And I'd have all the assignments inside that book done, you know, so that when teacher asked for it, I'd just give them the assignment. They hated it because they usually picked like 5 questions on the thing, and I'd have all 15 questions done. But, you know, I would just give them the work. And my teachers understood that I was gifted, because when I had an interest in something, I would deep dive into it. But when I didn't have an interest in something, I was completely tuned out. But I still learned the material. You know, it was just I learned it on my own time in my own way. So it really was one of those, like, I loved certain, like, I hated science, but I loved like the project where I had to build my own biosphere, you know, and it was like I could do that because that revolved my imagination, and I was very inner gifted. And so my teachers were like, she knows the material, it's just she doesn't, you know, like want to do the assignments. And I figured my kids would probably end up being the same. So
So, and I wonder, as a parent, what does it ask from you to homeschool?
to
Because,
trust my kids.
yeah.
That's probably been the biggest thing for me, is like trusting that, you know, if I give them opportunities to learn, they'll learn. They may be quiet the whole time. They may not engage in conversation. I'm a conversationalist, you know. But it amazes me all the time, like things my kids know. And I'm like, where did you learn that? Because I didn't teach it to you. And it's just because people are natural learners. We just don't treat them as such. And we don't give them the opportunities to do so. You know, we even in the workforce, like you have your job, and the skill sets around your job, you could actually be to spend some of your day learning those other skill sets, you know, and you would be more productive for your company. But we don't allow that time in because we want them to focus on productivity. And that goes a lot for pretty much any, even like as a writer, people care more about how many books can I put out a year, or how many words can I write, versus, you know, what can I learn and explore and do that will let me grow as a storyteller. And so
Actually, it's very resonating with me as well. As in education, I teach University of Applied Sciences, and those are students a lot. I guide or I grade their final thesis, which is quite in the context of applying a theory, but they still need to write a lot. And then it's all about this dilemma, this wrestle between productivity, because there's a certain time and then it needs to be so many words, there's so many pages. And what have you found with all your embodied and cyclical wisdom is can help for all also colleagues who need to write to find more balance in that productivity?
I do everything kind of in a cyclical way. So I know we've had this conversation before privately, but like there's a seasonal, the big picture, and I kind of allow my energy to follow the season for me. So winter is actually a more productive time for me than summer, because our summers are very, very hot and I just get overwhelmed. I apologize. And so I typically like kind of follow my own energy patterns through the year. But then on a smaller scale, I do it on a weekly and a moon cycle basis. So I've set my schedule based on the like a 28 day, which is really kind of a 21 day. Like what can I do in the next 21 days, and then take a break and energize, recharge into that next season. And typically my recharge week is also kind of my cycle week. So it lets me really truly have that down period of I need to breathe, I need to work, and I can recharge into like what I have energy to do again. So that on that level, I do that. And then I also have a doing and being kind of ebb and flow in my very individual week. And I'm kind of modifying that right now with that new system of I'm trying to spend 3 days creating, and like the work, the creative process of writing words and building a business and coaching and all that part. And then, right after that, I cultivate the relationships with other people. So like doing this interview or putting things up on social media or however I want to do that. And then I spend 2 days doing that. And then I spend 1 day contemplating what I want to do next towards my month, big month picture. And then 1 day curating content and learning, because it's very easy for me to fall into the curating hole. I'm an avid researcher, but if I kind of isolate it down to 1 day, then I really kind of look for what's really valuable instead of letting myself graze a little too long. And then I get back into creating. And so like following that has let me kind of start to feel like, okay, there's a pattern to this ebbing and flowing. So that contemplating day and the curating day are very being for me. It's just, like looking through the materials and having fun and exploring. And then the creating is very doing. And the cultivating is kind of a mix of both of the depending on what I'm doing with it. I can either be with my family and be with myself and be with my friends, or I can do like this interview here where I'm kind of more engaged in an activity. So it's really letting me do a blending of both and kind of finding that what I call like a sewing treadle pedal, it's that back and forth of going from doing and being. And then my migraines, I kind of just work around. So sometimes, I don't get a creating day or I don't get a contemplating day. And that's okay, because maybe I just don't need them right then. I kind of trust my body to tell me that. So.
So that it's like this figure eight. The in Dutch we say lemniscaat. I don't know if lemniscaat is I don't think it's the English word for it, but it's this figure eight, this constant movement between the being, where it's just also allowing to not produce and see what comes up. Actually, I have a question here. Is it how do you, because that's my enthusiasm. I tried when we spoke. I was so captivated by the way you level it down, like on year base. So that's maybe for the listeners. You first have the year, which has a certain calendar, and then you break it down into the seasons. First of all, with the winter, spring, summer, and autumn, that have each their own qualities and their characters and qualities to bring into your life. Then you say there's the moon cycle, which is the month indicator of 28
There's
days.
typically 3 moon cycles in a season, so they don't fit perfectly, but
And then you can link them to the feminine cycle, as in the menstrual cycle also, which for me would sometimes count. There's five cycles in just a month. Oh no, that's over exaggerating, but at least in a season. So that differs for everybody. And then you have the doing and being, which is like in the week, where you have a time frame of like 3 days of creating and then slowing down to allow a certain level of being. And then also an element of cultivating, you said, and ruminating. What was it?
It's contemplating, curating, creating, and cultivating.
So when you're in one, but the other gets activated. What happens? How do you tame that? How do you, or is it a personal rhythm, or could you say this is also a template that could work for others as well, and it over time grows on you?
Like I said, I'm kind of experimenting with it right now. I do find obviously like my default is to either contemplate or curate. Like I'm either thinking about it or I'm learning about it. That's kind of where my default is. And so I purposely made those shorter periods of time. And so if it comes up like yesterday, I was, trying to figure out my website stuff. I obviously had to go learn how to fix the problem, But what I did was I limited that time. Like I only focused on that one solution that I needed instead of going, oh, well, I could learn all these things about how to build a website, which is what I typically would do. So it's really just kind of reminding myself that my purpose for this day was to create and that I was not going to let myself fall down those other rabbit holes. Except for where it was necessary. So, I think there's probably even a flow to my regular day that has that kind of pattern in it. Like I wake up in the morning and I do a lot more thinking about things and how my day is going to go and all that stuff. But not staying there, not just journaling all day or, thinking about stories, or all the ways you can think about things and not actually do anything. And the same goes with like the cultivating relationships. Like sometimes, like this conversation here, I'm kind of talking about the things that I'm passionate about. And so it almost is a contemplating, it's like I'm getting to think about all these things that excite me. But instead of always keeping the conversation there, it's like I'm bringing it back to what's going to cultivate relationship with people that are going to get to know me. And so, like, that kind of thought process in my brain is like, it twists it around to keep it focused. And being ADHD, bunny trailing is natural. So having something that brings me back and having a system, one of the things that I'm really passionate about is habits are not good for ADHDers because we get bored with them, but systems are wonderful because if you can find a system, you can manipulate it and play with it
Can you give an example?
it. So like this, so this is a system. Versus setting a goal of saying, I'm going to build my website or I'm going to, write a book. By saying, I have time, like let's just take book writing because it's very straightforward. You think about what you're going to write, you kind of plot it out, you do all that part, then you go learn all the things you need to learn about the character's background and, like I don't know anything about firefighting, so I have to go learn all the things about firefighting, right? And then you spend a lot of time writing. A lot of time creating. But often what we do is we spend a whole lot of time in those first two and like we'll dabble in the writing in between it. And we don't actually get to like writing a full draft. And then the cultivating relationship is when you're done, you still have to like, publish it. You have to work with an editor, you have to work with a cover designer, you have to if you have an agent and a publisher, you have to work with them. You have to build relationships with your readers. Marketing, all that stuff is that cultivating relationship, right? A lot of us don't like that part because we're all in our heads, we're all over here. And so, by taking the system, though, instead of saying I have to write a book and I have to, market a book, what I get to do in a week is spend a little time thinking about books and what's yummy and like developing a little bit more on a storyline. And then I get to go and I get to do the curating, like learn one new thing that will help my story. And then I get to spend 3 days creating with the promise that I don't have to stay there because, that's the one of the reasons we kind of avoid the writing is like, oh, every day I have to get up and write. And then I get to go cultivate relationship, but that's also only 2 days. And it's like, I only have to like focus on my readers and like get on social media those 2 days. And so by doing it that way, it's a system. Instead of, I have to write a book. And like you always, maybe with your very, very first book, you might not have a cultivating relationships as much because you're not marketing, but you are like building your readership. You're talking to people and saying, this is what I'm writing about and this is what I'm passionate about. So in that sense, you might have maybe 1 day for cultivating instead of two. But I mean, that's again, it's a system. You can change that system. You can flex that system into how it works for you.
It
And
sounds like for me, when you said habits and then the way you started describing it, it also a system brings you flow and a certain roundness to get you to the bigger picture again. That's how I'm
Because the habit is just get your bottom in the chair and get your hands on the keyboard, right? Like that's
And it
really the
stays very
habit.
fractal and fragmented. So you also don't get to the whole picture where it becomes a thing that actually gets done.
Yes.
And the system helps you to finish it, even though it might not be perfect and you need another iteration and another iteration, but it
Right.
keeps you from or flowing and not from getting
And I
stuck.
would say that's true for education as well, because like, we as teachers and educators, we kind of focus on, okay, they got to write this essay, or they've got to learn this material, or and the habit is, sit and read the book, or sit and take the test, how to write like the 5-paragraph essay, like all those things. Like it's a very fragmented thing, but when you think of it in a bigger picture of of the process and the system that you want them as a lifelong learner to have, to write an essay, like to observe and to go and do some research and to, write those ideas down in some kind of common book that they can, keep notes in, and then to organize those ideas and then to, refine those ideas and maybe talk it out with somebody, so that they can work in that social component, or during the research, you can do it in lots of places. But like having a system where it's not just the activity, it's really like this is how you learn and, take that knowledge, organize that knowledge, and express that knowledge. Then suddenly everything in their life is, oh, look, there's a new piece of knowledge. What can I do with that knowledge? And then how can I express that knowledge and share that knowledge with other people? And you have a system for learning instead of, I know how to write an essay.
And it also brings me back to the element of the cyclical part and also the self-knowledge, I would say, because of what I'm thinking is what when you were talking, also to connect it to your own rhythm. That's what I'm hearing as well, where you find your rhythm where it works better. Because sometimes I might be better in the morning than the evening to do my writing and do some real hard creation stuff. I don't do that in the evening. In the evening, I can, fix some bugs on the website, which are easy to do, and to find your flow. And for me, the 3 days before bleeding, I want to get shit done to close my cycle. And I'm so hyper active, and I'm really good at getting things towards the end, I noticed. So it's so beautiful what you're saying. I'm like, oh, yes, if you are allowed to follow this rhythm in
Yes.
education, and then having provided or search for together, like you're talking about with homeschooling, a system that holds it together and moves with you in the process you're in to get to your purpose intention of the bigger year where you're learning. It's like, oh, what a totally different system to land in.
And to work in, like I mean,
Oh, yes.
honestly, if I'd had these skills like when I was in the academic environment or when I was in the work environment, and just being able to like take back that control of how my time went, I think I would have been more engaged in the process instead of disengaged and just doing, checking the boxes essentially of, this is what the teacher wants and this is what the boss wants. I would have been more engaged with it, being able to like ebb and flow and say, okay, well, today I'm going to talk to, my coworkers and see what, kind of situations we're working with, problems we're dealing with, and what solutions would they want to do. There's that's cultivating, right? And then, maybe contemplate some solutions, do some research on how to get it, make that transition happen, and then create those solutions, right? Like we would have had a better environment instead of we're just getting the work done, or we're just, just checking the what we call core skills, like you're just kind of checking off the core skills that kids have to learn for the test. That doesn't help a kid want to be a lifelong learner. And so like if they had had if we and then the thing is like even the kids don't even have to have the same system. Like they could all have their own system of how they get stuff done. It's just like what works for them. And if they can really embody that, then they are actively learning and the content becomes secondary. because it's like they can learn anything. And that's honestly the biggest problem with American education, at least, is that kids don't want to learn because of the it's just it doesn't engage them. It doesn't, you know, it's not something they want to embody. And honestly, I probably wouldn't want to embody education that way either. It's not fulfilling to the soul.
No. While you were talking, it already creates resistance within me, which is actually having the opposite effect of creating even a
Exactly.
worse environment of where learning should be
It, and so
key.
like that to me, like that's the whole thing about embodiment that I really am passionate about. And it's one of the reasons I'm shifting my business so drastically. Like everybody's like, so what are we doing now? And I'm like, well, it's completely different than what we were doing before. And it's that it's that's ability to like truly embody the process of story and to have like your story of how you live your life be fulfilling and not just I'm checking the boxes of what I'm supposed to do because this is what writers do, right? And it same goes for educators. It's like this is what educators do, so this is how I have to do it. And we copy people, and it's not fulfilling to this part of us because it's not true to us. It's not true to who we are, which goes back to my whole priority of authenticity. It's just like if it's not who you are, then it's never going to be a system that works for you or a habit that works for you. And I think that's why like things like dieting plans and stuff don't work for people. It's because it's not who they are. It's not true to their needs and their bodies, and they're not listening to themselves. So that's kind of where I'm getting back to is like how to teach people how to listen to their own needs.
Yeah. And while you were talking and embodiment and skills, I was thinking, as the question I always ask all my guests, is there any skills to get a taste from how you embody the work you do with in the context with writers, with co-author or authors, and in the way you, yeah, teach all the cyclical embodied wisdom?
So one of the things that I feel is really important is knowing how you're feeling or how you even want to feel about something. So I have 70 different writing projects going right now. And it's because certain ones give me certain feelings, right? When I'm angry, I'll work on this story over here. And when I'm, you know, really excited, I'll work on the story over here. And it's because those stories give me those specific types of feelings. And so, I know not everybody is feeling driven, but I still think even like the most, you know, cerebral person still has a feeling that they want to have in that cerebral experience. So embodying our feelings is one of the things that we typically call it emotional intelligence. But like that ability to embody our feelings is what lets us be good communicators. It's what lets us be good learners, even because it, you know, if you're scared to learn something and you're not acknowledging that fear, then you're going to be that resistance, right? But if you acknowledge that you're scared, then you can approach it with a curiosity, a cautious curiosity, right? And so, what does cautious look like in the body? Well, it's not going to be resistant, which is like, you know, folding your arms, stepping back, putting that distance between you and that thing, maybe a tight jaw. Those are the physical embodiments of resistance or stress. And if you can learn to read your body, the other thing is that like you may not know, like a lot of people just aren't emotionally aware that you are being resistant in a conversation. But if you can know that your resistance is to fold your arms or to look away or to do that thing, you can pick up on your own body cues and realize, oh, something about this person or something about the situation is making me, you know, want to not be attached. And so you can decide if that's a healthy relationship or if that's a healthy situation to be in. And so one of the things that I love to do with kids and with authors and when I'm coaching them or anyone is take the emotion wheel and go through and try to figure out which one you are. Now, for writers, I typically say, like, let's express, oh, let's say, what does it feel like to be out of control, right? What does that look like? And there's a lovely book by a dear friend called The Emotion Thesaurus. And she literally took a bunch of the emotions and wrote the physical kind of characteristics of them. And it is one of the first resources I ever used as a writer because, you have to describe things differently. You can't always have them folding their arms. It gets really boring. And so it's like, what else could that, what would out of control look like? It might be throwing up my arms and shouting and, my face turning red and this like kind of aggressive forward momentum of, yelling at somebody, or putting one foot forward as in a threatening, like I'm going to attack you type posture. That out of controlness is something you as a person can literally embody just thinking about how it feels. And if you
Or
can
maybe
learn,
doing it, like getting in that position,
exactly,
right? And just gently
it's
stepping.
just theatrics, it's all it is. But because we literally embody our emotions, if you do the body movements, you get the emotion. If you think about the emotion, you get the body movements. And in order to build your emotional intelligence, especially as a child, so children, we kind of focus on the main six emotions, anger and sadness and happy and surprise. And we get them to think about what that looks like. That's what most children's like picture books are, is showing them what this experience of being human is like. Getting them to embody what that looks like and then to find healthy ways to deal with it. So like, a child who throws something at another child, we help them figure out that is definitely one way we show that we're angry, but let's find another way to show them we're angry. Maybe we stomp our foot or we, do something like with our jaw being tight, or do you notice how red his face is? Because he's really angry, right? And so you show them those things so that they can identify emotion and to express emotion in healthy ways, right? And
And you
so,
have the skill of noticing.
yeah. And so it's like, if you can do that, like that is the best skill in the entire world. And you, even adults, like we talk about it all the time that people just don't have the emotional awareness or emotional intelligence. It's like we can learn this as adults as well. And if you can do that wheel, I think there's like, I think like six or seven things for each of the main emotions. Like learn to express all of those nuanced differences between being out of control and being rage. Like those aren't necessarily exactly the same thing. Being out of control, you can be in rage but still be in control.
Control.
And so like knowing those nuanced differences between those two things is really powerful because it lets you decide which one are you really. You're not just angry, right? And
Maybe
that's
also to observe for yourself. I'm just thinking out loud, going crazy here. Like, oh yeah, I can see this happening. Like, where am I falling short? Like, where are my gaps in this wheel, right? What do I show more often? And what is actually a part I don't visit very often, which is not so much embodied inside of me, to actually thinking of embodiment and then growing range. And even also if you have a character, and I'm pointing to your books up there. The screen that you want to let grow and explore because you're having a hard time. Okay, maybe that is an area where I can grow and embolden a little bit the expression of a certain emotion to see what comes
And
up.
like, having autism in our family, there are certain emotions that are just really physically hard for us to express. So grief is one of mine. Like I can go to a funeral and not cry, but I will literally cry over a commercial with a cute little puppy. Like it's just I don't understand. It's not that I don't understand. It's that I don't know how to express it because I don't know how to really embody grief for somebody else. Because to me, that's love, and love is a very different expression than grief. And so, Like I know that about myself, and I know that I'm not going to cry at a funeral. I can pretend cry, like we can all pretend our emotions, but to me that's very inauthentic, and so I just don't do that. And I just let people know, I'm like, I know I can see you're really sad about this person dying, and it's like I really loved them too, and I think they can see my love, but they can't. I'm not going to falsify grief, and so.
It's interesting what you're saying here, because so first of all, when dealing with neurodiversity in the emotions, the spectrum of accessing emotions is different. So first of all, I guess for yourself, it's very important to notice and know and work with the qualities of how it is to access, for example, grief, and then also in relationship with other people who are actually very maybe expressive and might misinterpret it for lacking grief. So it's very interesting what you're pointing out here in relating with each other on emotional levels when there's neurodiversity involved.
Yeah, and this idea that like we have to show, like the other one I have a really hard time is gratitude and being grateful for things. It's not that I'm not appreciative of the thing. It's just I don't know how to really express gratitude. Like to me, if you give me something, I have to give you something back. It's an exchange kind of thing. And it makes me feel almost obligated. And so like in my brain, I almost like if I probably have a facial expression or something, but like it's like, oh, well, thank you for that opportunity. Thank you for that gift. Thank you for that thing. But I don't really sound sincere because I don't process it that way. Like to me, I should be able to just simply do things for somebody. And like I don't want anything in return. I don't want the gratitude. I don't need that, like, oh, it was such a great gift you gave me. All I want to do is simply love somebody and give them the gift. And that's one of the things they say about autistic people in general is that they're very loving. They're just really suck at expressing all the other emotions. Like we love you. It's immensely, and we value the relationship. But we don't need that neurotypical response. We don't need you to do anything. Our feelings are our feelings. Like it's not
Unconditional, it sounds.
this way. And so like if I went to a Christmas party with my husband and we won a trip and like I don't travel. So I wasn't grateful for it at all. In fact, I was actually embarrassed because I feel like it's a wasted gift, And my husband's like, oh, we won this thing, and I'll take my mom because she loves to go to, they're going to go to Costa Rica. They're going to go look at, geeky stuff. And they're both really nerdy,
There's good surf.
cultural people. So, like, that's their thing. They like to go look at, like, volcanoes and artifacts and all this. And it's not that I wouldn't find those things interesting. It's just I don't like to travel, like, all the other things that go with traveling. And so for me, it's like I was embarrassed. But I also knew that was not an appropriate reaction to have to winning a gift from somebody. And so I was kind of just me. I was just there and quiet. And that's typically an autistic response is because we either have to mask and be fake, which you can usually tell, or we have to just be honest, which is kind of a blank, neutral position. And that's the reality. So, but like being able to understand all of those emotional experiences is very important. Like, I still have to understand that when you're excited about something, it's a valid emotion to have. It's your emotion is not fake. It would be fake if I did it. But so,
Does it
what?
touch you and move you when others who are very emotional share that with you? How does it, or is it more a knowing that from
It's a
all?
knowing, yeah. It's very, I would say it's very cerebral. I'm a very big feeler, but it's a feeling of like I'll tell you this. Other people's emotions are more like waves. So if you're very, very excited, it's overwhelming to me. If you're very, very angry, it's overwhelming to me. Now, if you're just kind of miffed, I can probably ignore you. If you're just like, oh, look at that opportunity, I can decide if that opportunity really excites me. But it's my emotion. And I think that's the difference between a neurotypical response to emotion is we neurotypicals mimic each other. They're like, if one person gets excited, the other person gets excited. And neurodivergent people typically don't, because that's our emotion and we want to be authentic to the emotion that we're having and that we don't understand that response. So that's where I kind of find that. But that emotional wheel and being able to express emotion, like it's not that we don't have those emotions, we do about something.
Yeah, of course.
But like I literally will grieve a dead animal. Like if I hit a squirrel, it's the end of the world. But you know, when my grandmother died, I was just sad because, you know, I love her. I wasn't really upset or grieve in the grieving kind of way that everybody else was. So to me, it was just a quiet, solemn, you know, I'm going to miss those opportunities, and an expression of love. It's a very different thing than the grief I have over killing something I don't have a relationship with, because I don't really love the squirrel. I mean, I probably do love the squirrel, but you know, it's the
Fascinating
I
squirrel.
value that life, you know, and I've taken that life, and that causes me grief, and it's a very different experience, like what I'm supposed to
Maybe
have
also
after
when you're kind of involved
that.
with the car and being the bigger thing here and squashing it, there's a sense of guilt, right? Like, oh, I exist and I take up space in a way that can hurt in this case.
And I'm just and because we are sensitive, you know, highly sensitive people typically are neurodivergent. Then we do have that, like things can be overwhelming, like when there's a lot, like a concert. I don't really like concerts or like big party kind of things because
Too
everybody
much.
has big emotions and I'm so overwhelmed by just the presence that I don't get to enjoy the show. And so, like to me, I'd much rather watch a concert on TV where I can just enjoy the music and they kind of pan to the audience every once in a while to show you should feel this way.
You have your
But I
space.
can enjoy the music. It's just a different way of doing it.
It's interesting, and it's also reminding me of what I think is very good to realize in families, first of all, where I'm like, if the neurotypical, set the tone in gifts and emotions, they really should be a little bit educated. I hope they choose to be educated through conversations like this, to just know that if somebody doesn't respond in the way you expect, like you said, the mirroring, that it doesn't mean that it's wrong and they shouldn't take it personal, but they open up to the different ways of receiving and interacting when there's neurodiversity involved, and that they sometimes can't access the experience of the other person, which is very wonderful how you laid it out and shared it.
Thanks.
So cool. Well, not cool. It's I'm grateful for that, you showing it and us being able to share this with the world. And I really hope that more people listen and learn from this. I feel like we've been quite around the world of our topics that I wanted to reach today. Do you feel like something needs to be added to our s story for the embodied educator?
I would just say, like, really, just one of the biggest things I've learned about embodiment, and this is a fairly newer, like, to me, thinking about embodiment is a fairly newer. I'm 43, and I think it's only been about 5 or 6 years that I've really focused on like what embodiment is. Is that it's something we really have to like learn the value of. It's a nutrition. It's nourishing to us that to understand that our bodies are always telling us something and our bodies are always reacting to something. And so one of the biggest things I'm shifting my business in is like just being aware of how our nervous systems are reacting and that it doesn't always have to be the true story, right? So I get my default reaction to things is anxiety, because it's overwhelming. But it doesn't have to, like, it's, I can just kind of self-compassionately acknowledge, okay, this is a new experience. Anxiety is a very normal part of being in a new experience, but anxiety can be shifted to excitement. It's the exact same physical experience. It's the only difference is the mindset that's going with it.
Storytelling that comes with it, right?
Yeah, it's the mental story I'm telling myself. You know, it's like, so you know, I was anxious to do this interview, right? But I can also be excited to do this interview. And it's still going to present in my body the exact same way. It's just the story I'm telling myself about it. And a lot of our emotions are that way. When we're resistant to something, you're also cautious to something. You can approach it with caution. You know, when you're, oh, like, I do this with people who are overexcited about things. I'm like, you're just eager. Like, you can tone that down, that overexcitement to eagerness and like looking forward, anticipation. Like, so if you can learn again that emotion wheel, like you can learn to like manipulate what looks the same in your body, and to be able to switch between them. And so for me, anxiety, I'm like, okay, can I approach this with curiosity? You know, can I be excited about it instead of anxious about it and like where that wall goes up in my body? And so that's just one of those skills I really wish people understood a little bit more, is that our bodies only have a certain amount of expression, and we can literally control how, the story we're telling ourselves that is attached to those emotions.
It's also reminds me of the book that we where we share a teacher and we share some homework of Jill Bolte Taylor with the characters where we can actually actively step into a different part of an experience, a different character within us to see if there's any other qualities or emotions online. And I thought, is there something wrong with the
No, my dogs are getting excited, so
sound? I thought so. You warned me
I'm
for
like, just go open the back door, they'll go outside.
No, the Jill Bolte Taylor and the quality that we can access with our characters online to access different. Although, and that's I think the beauty you just stated, it does require some awareness, which you can get through embodiment and choice, the element of choice to be willing to try the emotion wheel or anything else that we're offering with our embodiment, passion and craziness and nervous system activities to access it and to see if it works any different for you. So, wow. Yeah, it's a beautiful way of bringing everything together that we spoke about. One more question. If people like to hear, read, work with you, how do they get in touch?
I just updated my website yesterday, as I was saying earlier. I have a new, you can go to authorjessicawhite.com, which is my, like, it's the same page, but I've actually switched it to my new business, which is authorsapothecary.com. And I write books, but I also coach authors in both the writing process and in developing who they are as a writer. And then I also am starting a new group, a community, new community called the Authors Apothecary that's based on living in that cyclical living and setting intentions, but also the self-awareness of self-compassion and embodiment work, somatic work and breath work that can help us calm our nervous system so we can be creative, because a lot of times we just don't feel safe and we avoid the work. And so if you can kind of use the embodiment tools to find your I'm safe, I can jump into the story, the unknowns of the story. You can usually get past that writer's block or that imposter syndrome that is keeping you from writing.
Lovely. Thank you so much for
Thank
sharing
you, Liz.
this. And I wish you a lovely day. I'm in the dark now and you're getting ahead
I
in the
know, my sun is coming up.
A warm thank you for staying until the end. If you like this, it would mean a great deal if you gave a review on Spotify or iTunes. Stars are also appreciated to spread more embodied sparks across education. Maybe some colleagues or friends might like this episode. Please share with the world, and together let's move our educational world forward one step at a time.